This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even someone who doesn't make much of his or her birthdays can be thrown for a loop when reaching the age of 70. That was the case for Doris Grumbach. Her new book is a memoir of the year she turned 70. The year was 1988. And although the year began with feelings of despair, the despair led to a change that started a new and very fulfilling chapter of her life. Grumbach is a novelist and literary critic. She's former literary editor of The New Republic, and you may remember her book reviews on Morning Edition. So, how bad was her 70th birthday?
I was stunned by how awful it was. I don't even know now why it was so awful. I knew why 60 was painful, because my mother had died at 59, and I hated the idea of going on from that age to where I was. But 70, I was totally unprepared to be so despairing. And as I think I indicated in the memoir, the reason I now believe it was so painful was that in that year, so many of my friends, young friends, had died of AIDS. And I was struck forcibly by the disparity between living to be 70, healthy and in good shape, and they're dying so young. And I think that may have thrown me into despair. It's a sort of survival guilt or something of that sort.
Well, you describe something you wrote for a friend of yours to be read at his funeral. And you say, but when you turned 70, what you wrote for his funeral started to sound phony to you. What did you write, and why did you have a change of heart about it?
Well, I tried to suggest some better things about death. You know, death is only a passage. Death is moving from one state to another. And I said all these things blithely, and then afterwards thought about it and thought, there are no really consolatory words for the death of a young, talented man who dies so prematurely and so tragically. And I hated the words I'd said. I think I said them for his lover, who was present in the audience. I addressed them to him, hoping that it would console him. But then he died within a short time.
Have you felt that you've been able to be there and to do what you've wanted to do, what you felt capable of doing for sick friends?
Well, you never feel adequate to that. I miss the death of the man closest to me, my editor, Bill Whitehead, by an hour. I went racing up, as I say in the book, from Washington to New York, and got there just after he died. I did see a lot of him before that, but I wanted to say goodbye in a formal way. So I gave up trying to be closer geographically to the people I loved. There was another friend in California whom I saw close to his death, but not at the moment of his death, and I began to work in the AIDS ward of the Capitol Hill Hospital, where the group I belonged to, an Episcopal church service group for AIDS, had a little unit. And perhaps by that I had the feeling that I was doing something for the others. I don't know.
You made a very big change in your life during your 70th year. You moved from the city, Washington, D.C., to the country, Maine, and you bought a home by a cove in Maine. It really sounds beautiful. Why did you want to get out of the city?
Well, the city and the part of Washington that I knew is increasingly uncomfortable for someone my age. I walk very slowly, and I have white hair, and I come home late at night from Kennedy Center, the Arena Theater, or the Folger, wherever, and had to park a block or a block and a half from my Capitol Hill house. And I never felt safe. I never believed that I wasn't going to get mugged. In fact, 2 weeks before we finally moved, someone was mugged on our street. My car was stolen and trashed from in front of the door, when one of the few times when I was able to park there. Our bookstore on 7th Street was broken into twice, and we had to put up bars and an alarm system and that sort of thing. I felt that the city was becoming increasingly threatening, and that I, who have always been a firm fighter for civil rights and for the rights of minorities, was becoming a racist. And I hated it. I hated it in myself. If I saw a couple of black kids walking down the street approaching me at night, I was scared, and I didn't like that. So I asked my companion in life whether we couldn't think about living elsewhere, and she said, sure, if we can find a place for the bookstore. And we did.
Were you afraid of making as big a change as that at the age of 70? A lot of people feel that when you turn 70, you should be kind of settling in and staying in the secure place and a familiar place that you've already lived in.
Was I afraid? Yes, I think I was. But not of those things. I always thought I could build support systems pretty quickly. And, of course, I should confess to you that we kept an apartment in Washington for what are known in Maine as the bad months, from January to mid-April. And so I go down there for many of the support things I need medically or dentally that I don't try to do in Maine. But I found the change exhilarating. I think I would have never gotten out of that mood of despair and feeling that everything was falling apart if I hadn't moved to Maine, in that cove and in those woods and on the deck of that house. I feel renewed. It's a new landscape. It's a new horizon, a lot of horizon. It's a place where I can write in quiet. And I was afraid of doing it because I thought maybe it would be a place I couldn't write. And I had already found a wonderful carriage house in Washington where things went well. May Sarton talks about the muse, and I was worried about the muse not conveying, but it did.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer and literary critic Doris Grumbach, and you may also remember her as a former book reviewer on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. We just discussed one big change you made in your life at the age of 70, the decision to move from Washington to Maine. There's another very big change you made in your life that I want to ask you about that you allude to in your new memoir. At the age of 54, you were married, but you decided to leave your family, your job, and your city of the time, which was Albany, New York. What changed in you that made that change so essential?
Well, I had the feeling that I wanted to be a writer, and until that time, except for journalism, reviewing, I had been a teacher. Most of my children were gone. There was no one.
Grown.
Yes, you know, gone off to college and then marriage and that sort of thing. And I think my husband, who is and was a wonderful man, found it very hard to be married to me with my needs, for the needs that someone has who is a writer. And at one point in my life, I wanted to go and live and teach in another city, and we fell out about this. And so I had this curious feeling that I needed to do something else, or else I would never get a chance to do it. So I left Of course, I never left my children. They had left us to go on to school, but I left and went to do what I thought I had to do. I'm certainly glad I did it. I don't think it was such a courageous thing to do as some people seem to think. I had enough money to support myself, and I just went.
What are some of the ways you wanted your life to change?
Well, I guess, to be honest, I wanted not to be married. I wanted to be, for the first time in my life, my own person. I wanted to make all the decisions that had to be made, not because of what the children needed or what my husband needed or what his career needed, but selfishly what I needed. I think that was the major thing. I went off to Saratoga to be on the sort of think tank committee of a newly formed college there called Empire State College. And I lived in a room in an old house, which I fitted up as a kitchen, dining room, bedroom, sitting room. And all in one, everything but the bathroom, which was off in another part of the house. And for the first time in all those years of marriage, 31 years, and before that of being in a family, I felt I was my own person. I had nothing and I had everything. And it was from that on, that time on, that everything happened to me. I went to Washington on the invitation of the editor of the New Republic to serve as a literary editor, a purely serendipitous move. I had very few qualifications, and to this day, I don't know why he asked me. I think it was an act of a leap of faith that I find incredible. But it was then that you know, the life I have now started, you know, the publication of chamber music and the critical life I've had has all started after I was, you know, I was pretty old by then, I guess, 50, in my late 50s.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer and literary critic Doris Grumbach, who's written a new memoir about her 70th year. It's called Coming Into the End Zone. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Doris Grumbach is my guest. You are of the generation where it was just expected that a woman would get married and have children and, you know, be the mother within a nuclear family. Do you ever think that if it wasn't expected of you, perhaps you would have chosen a different life?
No, I don't think so. I think I want to be very clear about this. I had a very good marriage. I didn't stay there for 31 years because it was bad. It was not. And I had a good time raising my children. Oh, I thought many times, you know, if I didn't have them, I'd be able to write. But that was usually a passing thought. I always thought, when they are raised, then I'm going to do something else. But while I was doing it, I was happy. I don't regret for one minute having married, and I think probably I would do it again, if only for the experience of a good marriage and the pleasures of motherhood, which I would not forego for anything. I think you have to think of it in terms of periods in your life. It was true in my mother's time and certainly in the beginning of my time that there was one period. It just was one long period. You did the same thing for 75 years or 80 years or however long you were lucky enough to live. Now, with the women's movement and with new ways of looking at life as a series of stages, I think it's possible to have many things in it, to be many things, to experience many changes, even sexual ones. And I feel enormously lucky that I've been able to do that.
You mentioned sexual changes. One of the changes you made in your life is you began a relationship with another woman. And I'm wondering, if friends of yours were really shocked by that?
I don't know. The people who stayed friends with me appeared not to be shocked, and those that I never saw again, I don't know what they thought. It never concerned me, really.
Yeah.
I think of sex as a private matter, which sort of like defecation. It's something that choice you make. It didn't materially affect my acquaintances or my friends or my children. Of course, I'm sure it affected my husband. And that I regret, because to this day we are friends and I'm very fond of him, really. I think he married a wonderful woman after, and much better wife than I had ever been, and so he has a good life now. And I have a good life, and I think it was time probably for both of us.
I want to quote something from your novel, Chamber Music. And this is from a section where the novel is narrated by a woman who's 90 years old and is looking back on her life. And when she became a widow, she found herself falling in love with the woman who had nursed her husband. And they begin a relationship and live together. And the woman narrating the novel writes, "We made no public announcement of what was, after all, a private intention, nor was there any need for ostentation. The world would not have sanctioned it, nor, for that matter, believed it of me." I was wondering if you were thinking of yourself there, thinking like, oh, the world wouldn't even believe this of me.
Well, it was the way it was, actually. You know, I was woman of a certain age with children and who'd been married for many years, and I'm sure it never occurred to them that I had formed a new relationship, which is now 18 years old. It hardly seems new. I guess I was, when I wrote of Carrie, thinking of that.
As you get older, are you finding your taste in literature changing at all? And I'm wondering if you are turning to more literature about people who are in their 70s or written by authors when they were in their 70s.
Not at all. My literature, my taste in literature has changed, but it hasn't changed in that direction. It's gone back to my old taste, which is for writers that I liked when I was younger. Dickens, for example. I've been rereading Dickens delightedly, enormous pleasure. I'm not as interested in new young writers anymore, although I've taught a lot of them, and when I see their work, I'm glad to see it. But I find that I'm impatient with a lot of contemporary literature. I go back to the moderns a lot, to Fitzgerald and Virginia Woolf and D.H. Lawrence. Foreign writers like Thomas Mann and Camus and Kafka and Proust, they were the contemporaries of my youth, and I get much more pleasure out of rereading them than reading many of the efforts of the contemporaries. There are contemporary writers whom I greatly respect, don't misunderstand. But for the long term, I think, when you do get older, it is those writers who left their thumbprint on your psyche, so to speak, that you read with greatest pleasure.
Do you think of yourself as having totally overcome the depression of having turned 70 and of entering your 70s? Or does that still get to you sometimes?
Oh, yes. I think I'm by nature a pessimist. My friend and companion is an optimist, and she's always certain things are going to work out well. I'm always certain they're not going to work out at all, and very diffident about entering into them because I see no possibility that they'll end well. She's more often right than I am, but that doesn't seem to tutor me very well. I go on expecting things not to happen. And I do have long periods in which I despair of the world and its shape and politics and the American scene and the shape of the world ecologically. And I think of the world I'm leaving to my grandchildren. I'm horrified that I've let it happen in any way at all, and yet you look at it and it bears no resemblance to the world I was born into, at least the world I thought I knew when I was young. So I still despair.
But
I think life, you know, is worth living, and I think you have to take the beauty that you have, even if it's transient, even if developers are likely to dig in on all sides of you, even if your water won't always be pure, the little part you have of it is, even if the air in Maine is better than it was in Washington, maybe it won't always be, but you have to now live in the moment you've got and be grateful for God's grace that you've had that time. So I guess it isn't all despair.
Novelist and literary critic Doris Grumbach. Her new memoir is called Coming into the End Zone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.